plus 1 as an example. So the 3 plus 1D topological insulator with temporal invariance, and that's the topological invariant can be written as a momentum space transaminous term integrated over the 3D momentum space. That's called the transaminous polarization. And the corresponding surface state is a massless Dirac fermion. And all the copies of it. The corresponding field theory is a E dot B theory or axion theory. And the question is, if we study all these different topological phenomena, they all look similar. And so then it turns out that it's very natural to get a unified picture where you have a bending insulator in a generic dimension, even if it's not a topological bending insulator. You can still have some topological phenomena in it, and that's generally defined, described by a phase space transcendent theory, and corresponds to some generic fermion theory on the surface, which has no mass term. So let me briefly review, let's say, in the quantum Hall case, which is the best known case of topological insulator. So by Solis and his collaborators' work, TKN's work in 1982. So we know the reason why the Hall conductance is quantized in the integer quantum Hall case is it corresponds to a Chern number in the Brillouin zone. So Chern number is defined by you integrate over the barrier phase curvature around on a two-dimensional Brillouin zone. Then you get a flux, and that flux is always 2 pi times the integer. And that's the first Chern number. And I would like to mention that this quantization is also true for a generic many-body system by using twist boundary conditions as shown in the paper of Niu Solis and Professor Yingxu Wu here. And then later, so the discussion I will do later is focusing on the band case with the Brillouin zone. So this is the first Chern number. And if we look at the edge of quantum Hall insulator, the edge state is a chiral fermion for the integer quantum Hall case. And how do we know this system is topologically stable? This is a topologically different phase of matter. That's by you look at the edge state, and edge state is chiral, and there is this this axial anomaly of the edge states. It means that if you only look at your 1D, 1 plus 1D edge system, then you find when you apply electric field, your charge is not conserved. And the reason is, in condensed matter, we can easily understand why is that. Because when you apply electric field, then you have a Hall current, and the charge flows to the other edge. And that's why it's not conserved. So in high energy, it's called Cullen-Harry effect. And on the other hand, you have a no-go theorem, which means you cannot define this chiral edge states on a 1D lattice theory. Because in any 1D theory, you draw your energy spectrum. If you go up, go above the Fermi level, then you need to go down again because it's periodic in K. So it's a simple, so it's the simplest case of this Nielsen-Ninomiya no-go theorem. And then if you want to write down the topological field theory then of the quantum Hall insulator, so here, by topological field theory, I mean the topological theory which describes the response of your system. And that's done by you couple your quantum Hall system to an external electromagnetic field, A. And then you integrate out your fermion, then you get a quadratic action, looks like this, and that's the transaminous action. And this action is actually equivalent to the motion equation that you take a derivative to the A, then you get the Hall response. Like electric field generate a current perpendicularly. And this action is topological invariant, just like this coefficient itself is a Chern number that's already, that's also topological invariant. So this is just a brief summary of quantum Hall. So in quantum Hall case, how do we get this transaminous action? You don't need to do anything which is really field theory. I mean, you just calculate a bubble diagram you just calculate a Cooper formula and a current correlation function that will give you the Hall conductance. And if you write down it as a field theory, then that corresponds to a quadratic term in your field theory, and that's the transaminous theory. But the thing is, so then we know, according to more balanced and Fu Kang-Mili and Rahul Roy's work. So they generalize the 2D cone spin Hall to 3D, and there is a D2. And then it's natural to ask that, how do I detect this D2 topological insulator? And what's the way to find the topological invariant? Then you want to calculate in the same way as quantum Hall, I calculate the response of my system to electromagnetic field. And you find in the bubble, in the two-leg diagram means you have current-current correlation, or you take three currents correlation, or you take more, but you never get a topological invariant. And why is that? You never get a topological term. And why is that? And it's simply because what's the possible topological term in 3 plus 1? The only possible term is the E dot B. And that E dot B won't appear in all these calculations because E dot B doesn't appear in the motion equation. It only appears when you have a boundary, and then we'll talk later. But for a uniform system, it doesn't change anything in the motion equation. That's why you cannot get it from this calculation of the response. So then we know to improve that, to how to overcome that problem. And the way is you consider a spatial or temporal inhomogeneity, and parameterized by a parameter theta. And that theta can be any parameter. That just tell you your Hamiltonian is changing smoothly from here to there. And if you include that as a perturbation, I consider my system as homogeneous, but then consider this inhomogeneity as a small perturbation. And I also consider external electromagnetic field as a perturbation. Then combine these two kinds of perturbations, that give you a non-trivial response, which is a topological term like this. So you see your current is a response to this gauge vector potential here, and also your perturbation parameter theta. And the coefficients you can calculate, and you find that that's some topological term which looks like partial theta of something, and that something is the transamus term in the Brian zone. And in this way, you see there is a partial nu of theta, and there is a partial theta of this, so your theta drops off. So finally, you can just calculate your P3 locally, because locally I consider my system as translating invariant. So I sit here, and I see some band structure, and calculate P3, and then I change to a different location. And then you find if there is a spatial gradient of P3, then you get some topological response of it. So in our paper, we have done this calculation for a generic insulator. And so the corresponding effective theory, so we have calculated this diagram, and then you get a response of current to these two fields. And if you write down that as a response theory, you just multiply A mu to this side, and you will get this. You will get this P3, which is the transamus term integrated over momentum, times the FYJF, which Joe already talked about this morning. So then you get this E dot B theory, and that corresponds to the axion dynamics and theta vacuum discussed in the energy. So then for a periodic system, and then your P3 is a constant everywhere, and there is no topological response, although you have this topological term. And then with boundary, you have a topological response. So just briefly go through why is V2? Because, so in general, P3 is a phase. 2 pi P3 goes from 0 to 2 pi. That's because your transamus term is only gauge invariant modular 1. And that's a phase. So when you do time reversal, time minus itself, and there are two values which are time reversal invariant, and these correspond to zero and pi. So you immediately know that in any time reversal invariant band structure, I can get either zero or pi. And that gives me the Z2 classification to recover the earlier result. And it's basically just a generalization of the 1D polarization set. So there are these two classes. Okay, so these are just review. So, okay, so then we look at the boundary theory. So on the boundary of this 3D, we know so you have a domain wall where P3 changed from 1/2 to 0. And the P3 is a phase. Remember that it is a phase, so it can rotate either this way or the opposite way. So that gives you, then you write down the response theory, you find that I give you opposite Hall connection on the surface, which is E squared over H, or minus E squared over H. And this if you only look at the surface, then you see a single DR cone, and that corresponds to the parity anomaly of the surface theory. And I would like to emphasize that that's actually the only way to realize the parity anomaly, because if you really write down a 2D model with a single DR cone, then you must break time reversal at large K. Otherwise, you get doubling, and you get another DR cone somewhere. And if you break time reversal on somewhere on the large momentum, then you will get Hall conductance is integer. So only in this surface, you really get Hall conductance. And that also corresponds to a no-go theorem, which means if you have time reversal symmetry, then no lattice model single DR cone. And this is the no-go theorem talked discussed in Chongjun and Andrew and Shosheng's paper.
Yeah.
With this, sorry, when you have a time reversal and you require t squared equal to minus one. So then you see, in summary, we have seen this in these two examples that there are common features of the topological insulators, which are you always have some topological response, and you have a topological invariant in the bulk. And if you look at the boundary, there are some gapless edge states. And the gapless edge states have several properties which are all connected to each other. You have some kind of anomaly, and you have some kind of no-go theorem says that it's not possible to regularize it on the lattice. And you have another theorem says it's not possible to have mass under your under your required symmetry. So actually, these two are equivalent. So anytime when you have when it's not possible to give the fermion a mass, then it's not possible to regularize it on the lattice. Because if you regularize something on the lattice, then it's always possible to give it a mass. Okay, so then if the interesting thing comes when you compare these different classes. Then if you write down the quantum Hall effect transaminance theory, then it's written as this, right? So it's you have a transaminance and the coefficient is a Chern number. And if I write down the Chern number, it's an integration in the k-space of periphase curvature. So when you put this together, you find that it looks like a transaminance theory in the five dimensions. A mixed transaminance theory. It means this should be small f. This f is the curvature of the periphase curvature. And this capital A is the external electromagnetic field. So it is a mixed transaminance theory. I mean, you can check that this really recovers this result. And your small a leave, this small f only live in the momentum space. And this capital A only live in the real space. So other components of it just zero. The momentum component is zero. So this just looks like a trivial reformulation. But it's not so trivial when you go to the three dimensions and you find it looks still the same form. Because in the three dimension, you have a chain, you have a FYJF, the E dot B term in the real space. And the real space is 4D. And the momentum space is 3D. And the coefficient is P3, which is the transaminance term in the 3D space. So you put the transaminance term, multiply this Chern form, and they together still looks like a transaminance form. So it's a transaminance form now in a seven-dimensional space. And again, it's a mixed transaminance term with two capital A's and two small A's. Yeah.
When you
reformulate it, you mean in this case? So basically my manifold is like T5. I have brain zone, which is T2. Because it's T2, because it's T2, so I integrate over the two momentum, then it's quantized. I mean, I integrate over any closed surface, then the number is quantized. Something is wrong with this. Yeah, so, So if you reduce this to that, that requires that the small f only lives in the momentum space. Otherwise, you have other components, and the other components just give you different topological phenomena. And it's not describing quantum Hall, but it's also topological terms which exist in the insulator. It's similar here. I think you can have other components, but it's this component where you take these three as the momentum space, in the momentum space, that give you the 3D topological insulator. So then from these two examples, we see that although these two are characterized by a different topological invariant in the momentum space, but they are both characterized in the phase space by a transamic term. And that's it's consistent with the fact that your phase space, the phase space in my definition, is always all dimensional. If you have d plus one dimension and my space is d dimension, then I plus time, which is one, and then I have a momentum, which is momentum space is d dimension. So you always have 2d plus one dimensions. And you can write down your mixed transamic term with several capital A, several small a, where small a is a very phase curvature. And that give you, that is some response theory, right? Then I integrate over k, I get a general theory, and that always tells you some topological response. So to be more precise, so how do I get such phase space transamic terms? I just do the same kind of calculation. So these calculations are like I integrate my fermion and I study the response of my fermion. So remember this one gives me the E dot B theory. Means my current is response, it's a topological effect where my current has a response to both the change of theta, which is some spatial or time inhomogeneity, and the electromagnetic field. And if you do other diagrams like this, you can have a current response to no electromagnetic field, but all the parameters. But you need to choose the correct number of parameters so that you can get this topological form. Like you have three momentum here and one index here, so that you can make it anti-symmetric. So you will find that all the possible topological terms you can write down, finally, it reduces to this kind of phase space transamic term. Like you calculate this diagram, and that corresponds to a field effective theory with a capital A here, which is tell you the response of the current. And then these things are telling you some band structure change depending on the three parameters. And it just turns out that the coefficient match perfectly, and finally it just gave you this transamic form. And so let's take a different point of view, which may be easier to understand, and that's the topological surface space. So we have shown for the quantum Hall and the 3D topological insulator case that on one hand we have some box topological field theory and the topological invariant, and on the other hand you have the surface theory, which is some fermion, and the fermion mass is forbidden. And this can be generalized to generic dimensions. We can ask the question that what's in the generic dimension, what are the possible fermion theories which is forbidden to have mass term. So we know the easiest example are the Carroll fermion, and they only exist in even dimension of spacetime, like 1 plus 1, 3 plus 1. And the Carroll fermions are written in this way. The Hamiltonian can be written as gamma IKI, where gamma are Kalifi algebra generators. So you have already used all the Kalifi algebra generators, so that it's not possible to have a mass term, because mass term must be another gamma matrix which anti-commute with all of them. But like for example, in 3 plus 1, you get sigma dot k, which describes a Carroll fermion, and that you cannot have mass term simply because you already use all of the polymatrices, and that's why there is no mass term. And then we can have a little more complicated case where you have a mass term available, if you are not in the even dimension of space-time, then you don't have Carroll fermion, so you always have Dirac fermion and you can have mass term. But if you have some symmetry, then your symmetry forbidden the mass term, then you still get some topologically stable theory under the constraint of the symmetry. And that's the case like in quantum spin Hall or 3D topological insulator boundary. And let's see how that works. Like in 2 plus 1D, you write down the time, so you write down the surface theory is like this, sigma xkx, sigma yky. And there is a mass term here, but that's forbidden if you have time reversal symmetry. And the interesting thing is there is a relation between this and that. It's exactly because this theory is time reversal invariant that this is forbidden. It's because sigma dot k, remember, it's a 3 plus 1D Carroll fermion. It doesn't break time reversal. Because when you do time reversal, k k square equal to minus 1, this sigma change to minus sigma, k become minus k, and this theory is time-reversal invariant. But that means I can multiply sigma z by a k-linear term, so if you require time-reversal symmetry, then it's not possible to multiply sigma z by a constant term. And so that's why you don't have time-reversal, you don't have mass for the 2 plus 1 dk. So we see, so the insight here is we see there is a relation between the chiral fermion, which never have mass, and some lower dimensional non-chiral fermion, which if you don't require any symmetry, it can have mass, but because of this symmetry, then it's massless. So this is related to this dimensional reduction. It means I reduce the dimension, but if I keep the symmetry, I still don't have mass. If you only have single Dirac cone, like this, 2 by 2 theory, then I think you won't have mass even if you. Yes. 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 So the answer is if you have 2 Dirac cones, then of course you have open gap, right? But if you like in graphene, you only look at one cone. I don't consider the spin, and I also don't consider intervalley, and that's only one Dirac cone. Then even if you're it's still the spin, it's still not possible to open again.
Because we want
each
equal to minus one.
Yeah, but the thing is, if you have a single Dirac cone, then even if you define t squared is one, it's still not possible to regularize it on the lattice without brick T. So, yeah, that's the question. Answer this question. But T squared equals minus one means is required here. But if T squared is plus one, it's not possible to make it invariant. So, can we ask?
Yeah.
Okay. So then we have seen that. So what happened in this case? So in 4 plus 1 D, we have some generalization of quantum Hall effect, which I didn't have time to mention here, but you can generalize the quantum Hall first Chern number to a second Chern number. And on the boundary, you get the chiral fermion, which is sigma dot K. And then you remove 1 K, simply. And then you get this theory. And there is no mass if you have time reversal. And you remove another K, and it's still not possible to have mass. So you see, one chiral fermion has 2 descendants in the lower dimension. They are gapless. It was symmetry. And this can be simply generalized to generic dimensions. And in 2n plus 1 dimension, I have some insulator which corresponds to some Chern number in the 2n dimension. And that has a boundary theory which is the chiral fermion. And once you have the chiral fermion, then I try to find the symmetry which is compatible with this chiral fermion. Like in 3 plus 1, I know time reversal is compatible with chiral fermion. But in 1 plus 1, not. And you need to find the particle symmetry there. And so in general dimension, it turns out it's possible to find a symmetry with C or T, which is listed here, that for example, in 2D, it's particle symmetry. And that means if you define particle symmetry, then your chiral fermion is particle invariant. And in 4D is time reversal, and it turns out in 6D is particle Hall, 8D is time reversal, and the periodic 8. But the periodic 8 is not 4, and the reason is 6D case and 2D case, the particle symmetry are different by, in 2D case, C squared is 1, and in 6D, C squared is minus 1. It turns out that you must define in this way, otherwise your chiral fermion won't be invariant under that symmetry. So since I also mentioned these different symmetry classes. So we see that they emerge and automatically combine, locked with your special dimension. And then if this theory is invariant under such symmetry, then you remove the K-linear term, you cannot have a mass term. But it turns out that the non-trivial thing is you can only do that by 2 steps. Like I remove 1 K here and I get this theory and there is no mass term. And then remove 2 Ks and there is no mass term. And if you remove 3rd K, and you find, it turns out you can find a mass term. This you can easily show by you write down the like gamma, this 4x4 gamma matrices and show that. And that's related to this the descendant equations in the high energy in the mathematics. I mean, like you have this transform, and you have these two steps in the descendant equation. So in this way, we can get a table. Finally, so we compare this transformed series and the surface states, you get this tree. And the tree means here is the quantum hall. You see, this is the insulator which corresponds to the first Chern number. And I put it on the trunk, means it's topologically stable without relying on any symmetry, but relying on charge conservation. So, and here is the four dimensional, and in any even dimensions, you get the chain insulator. And then there are descendants. Each one has two descendants. And they are Z2 topological invariant. There are Z2 topological invariant defined in it, but you need to require different symmetries. So in 1D and 0D, I mean spatial dimensions, then if you require particle symmetry, you have Z2. But if you require time reversal, you won't get anything. But here, if you require time reversal, you get Z2. Here, you need to require that C tilde, which is particle, but C squared is minus 1. And here is T tilde, which is T squared equal to 1. And then you go back. So it's the Bott periodicity of 8. Yeah, the other good question. So the other points here means that you have a topological phenomenon, because so by these points, I mean you can write down corresponding transcendence terms. For example, here, I mean I have a mixed transcendence term, so I can choose like I have one capital A, two small A's, or one two capital A's, one small A. You can always make this kind of choice. So you have different topological phenomena, but you have a topological phenomenon doesn't mean you have a topological insulator. For example, in 1D, if you tune a parameter, you can make a charge pumping. And that doesn't mean this is a topological insulator. You can do the charge pumping by a parameterized trivial insulator. This one? Yeah. Yes. I think that's related. That's related to the proximity effect you talked about. So, so then you draw this line here, and below it is not physical, and these are all the topological theories available, and you have quantum hall here, 3D topological insulator, quantum spin hall, and these black points corresponding to some physical effects, and without topological insulators, and it's interesting to ask what's here and here, and you can write down the response equation. The question is the only question is how to realize in the realistic system. And you know they are corresponding to a Chern number. And there is a hope there you have fourth Chern number. There seems no theory from fifth Chern number. Yeah. Turn on what? Sure. I mean, in principle, of course, like I turn on long-range interaction in 1D, I can get 2D system, yeah, but just a little, yeah. Okay. So in summary, this is the summary, like I write down this mixed transcendence term. We know how to define transcendence term in 2D plus 1D dimension. And then I just put the transcendence term of A plus A. And you expand it, you get all these terms. And every term gives you a topological phenomenon. Like if you do it in E is 2 case, then you get quantum hall, quantum spin hall, and another one from search number. And this is perfect gauge field, this is external gauge field. So in summary, it's basically all the topological insulators, all the topological phenomena in band theory is in the transcendence hall. And this is the transcendence hall. and there is a transcendence hall in my home university. You can leave it there. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's why it's called transcendence. Yeah. Oh yeah. So actually, so the so what Shinsei talked about his classification is about both topological insulator and the topological superconductor, and our theory is only about topological insulators. Because I always couple my theory to an external electromagnetic field and talk about the response of my theory to the magnetic field, to the electromagnetic field capital A. that's a gauge vector potential, and and some other band theory band parameters. So if it's a superconductor, I cannot couple it to that. I cannot couple it to, I mean, if charge is not conserved, I cannot couple it to a U1 gauge field. You can still couple it. Exactly, but that gives you Higgs. And so then you cannot define these topological terms there, because Higgs is more relevant. And charge is not, and if you study BDG theory, then charge is really not conserved, then, yeah, it's hard. So that's a very interesting direction where we are trying to generalize this theory to more generalized sense, to include superconductors. With this insulator, our case agree with Shinsei's case, also agree with Alexei classification we will talk about. Yeah, but only these points with color, these blue and red colors, they are topological insulators. So others are some topological theory which tell you a phenomenon like charge pumping. That tell you, tell you some physical phenomena, but doesn't mean it is a new phase of matter. Yeah.
So like solid, talk about electron.
Yeah, that doesn't mean that's a topological system.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So I expect that some of these topological insulators described by this theory will be stable under when you turn on a many-body interaction. So what you need to do is something like an integral out momentum in this theory, and then I get some real space-time theory. And then I want to see whether I can forget about the momentum space and still this make this well defined. But I haven't found a universal way to do that. Yeah. Then sure. Yes. No, it's we are considering a system which can have spatial inhomogeneity or temporal inhomogeneity. It's not translation invariant, but we are considering the case of when the change is smooth. It's like a Boltzmann picture. I mean, I consider the case where locally I can still define band structure. I can consider the inhomogeneity as perturbation. Means like on time direction, I know it's just adiabaticity condition. And on spatial direction is the correspondence of adiabaticity.
So for example, in the block insulator, there's two blocks insulated, there could be, on the surface, there could be a scalar potential which doesn't
interfere with the rock insulation.
Even on the
team,
how would you know that this would eliminate the gap between the analysis?
On the surface, there can be
there could be a scalar potential.
Mm-hmm. But that just shifts the cone up and down. Just shift the cone up and down. And so it won't open gap. So the thing is you have these gamma matrices, and of course you can add all other terms like gamma A, B, but they don't open gap. So the only way to open gap is you need to anti-commute with all these coefficients of the K-linear terms. And that's exactly why you can only do it by two steps. Because if only gamma matrices are available, then you expect you always get this classification. But if you do the third step, you can find some other matrix which are intercommutable with it. And that turns out to be true in any branch of this tree. I see. So, I see. I think that these terms are there, but they never give you topological terms.
Yes, they are there.
They are there, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think it's true. Like in 3 plus 1 case, yeah. Like in 3 plus 1D case, besides the theta term, you also get the Maxwell, I think. Yeah. So you always get the non topological term. We just, the claim is the topological term exists, and it's written in this way. Yeah. Thank you.
I've given this talk before, and many slides are redundant for this advanced audience. So I'll go through them quickly. Just the main themes of my talk. I want to build a kind of periodic table, and these are the elements. This one? Oh, thank you. Yeah, this the elements I want to classify, and most of these materials have been mentioned, but I just want to mention this one. It's a zero dimensional case and the trivial case, because it's important to understand that first. Well, but I'll actually start with the quantum Hall case. It's a well-known example, and one can use the response theory and the Chern-Simons action, but one can also use a tight binding model to construct a Hall insulator, and it's a triangle lattice, and there is one unit, pi over two flux per triangle, which means unit flux per two unit cells, or four triangles. And one can do the band structure calculation and find this spectrum. There is a bulk spectrum with a gap and an edge mode without a gap. But let me remind you one important point about the band structure calculation. You diagonalize this Hamiltonian for each value of Q. So first you Fourier transform, you get a 2x2 matrix depending on Q, because there are two vertices per unit cell. And then you find the eigenvalues of the 2x2 matrix as a function of Q. But the eigenvalues are actually not very important. It is more important to consider the eigenvectors, and one can do this. One can do the spectrum flattening. One can reduce this Hamiltonian H of Q by another Hamiltonian which has eigenvalues plus and minus 1. And one can just consider the subspace corresponding to the minus 1 eigenvalue. It's a one-dimensional space in C2, and it has some winding number as a function of Q, and it's called the Chern class, and this is the famous formula for the Chern class. So I'll move on. And that formula is actually an invariant of a vector bundle over the Brillouin zone. And the classification of vector bundles is part of K-theory. And this table represents the both periodicity and complex K-theory. And it's not so important. K-theory comes from the letter K, which denotes the group of stable equivalence classes of vector bundles on some manifold. But there are many aspects. I'll show you in two slides what the essence of K-theory is. But for us, it's important that we deal with this coset, the unitary coset, and it appears in the following way. We have a Hamiltonian with n plus m degrees of freedom, n plus m modes, and we may suppose that n of them have negative energy and m have positive energy. And we're interested in the splitting of the whole space into the negative subspace, which is occupied by electrons, and the positive subspace, which is empty. And this coset is exactly the parameter space for such splittings. And if we ignore the magnitude of the eigenvalues, it's basically the space of Hamiltonians. It's not even, it shouldn't be attributed to random matrix ensembles or anything like that, because it's a property of a particular Hamiltonian.
What is the limit?
Oh, well, it's some technical detail, but basically I want to increase the dimension, and the purpose is that in high dimensions, the homotopy theory is simpler. And it's just to simplify the problem, we consider it in very high dimensions. And there are other homogeneous spaces that form a table with eight entries. And they're ordered in a certain way. And I'll show how this ordering is related to Clifford algebras. But if we combine the previous two classes and these eight classes, we get the whole set of Altman-Zernbauer classification, but in a certain order. And the order is important because I'll use a dimension shift, and it will be a cyclic permutation of those classes. Now, what is K-theory anyway? I mentioned that it's something about vector bundles, but if you don't like vector bundles, let me say that it's about matrices. It's a topological classification of matrices or matrix spaces. In theory, it's a simple problem. Suppose we want to classify maps from some space X to SON, their special orthogonal group. And for some reason, we want to take n to infinity. Let's do this calculation. If we classify maps from the circle, it's just the standard circle. So we're actually calculating the fundamental group of SON, and it's Z if n equals 2, and Z2 for higher values of n. At least for n equals 3, it's a well-known thing. Now, why are we taking the n to infinity limit? That's because things are easier in high dimensions. And basically, in high dimensions, all matrices commute up to homotopy. And not quite, but up to homotopy. And here's why. Suppose we want to commute X with Y, and we don't exactly commute. But we augment them by the identity matrix. And then we do this trick. We exchange Y and I, and this can be done continuously. It can be done by continuous rotation of the frame. And then this two matrices commute, we swap it and put Y on the right place. And that's the basic thing which shows that if we increase the dimension, everything becomes abelian. And the K-theory defines abelian groups. There is a construction called Grothendieck group. And I'll use this simplification. But what it tells us about physical problems is that we shouldn't be afraid to extend the system and add extra degrees of freedom, because it's only makes the problem simpler. If we want to classify a bent insulator with two bends, that may be hard, and I cannot do that. But with an unlimited number of bends, it's very easy. And here is the periodic table. There are two tables. The first table has only one entry. Some cells are empty, but that's because I only consider two symmetries, the charge conservation and the time reversal symmetry. I do not consider particle hole conjugation. And for instance, superconductors, I described as systems with no symmetry at all. They may be described as systems with both charge conservation and particle hole conjugation, with, which sort of cancel each other. But that description is redundant. And my description is minimal. So you see that there should be eight entries here, actually. In the vertical direction, it's the same table as before. It has entries associated with those classifying spaces. And this dimension is the spatial dimension of the system. And systems with the same symmetry type line up along diagonals of the table. So let me reiterate that there is one symmetry class that belongs to the mod 2 table. It's insulator without time reversal symmetry, and there are three symmetry classes that belong to the mod 8 table. And if there were other natural symmetries, we would have more class, more symmetric types, and those empty cells would be filled. And this is just with a few references to the talks you have already heard today. It's too fast, sorry.
We have more time, don't worry.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I'm sorry. Let me describe the main principles of the classification. We want to classify free-Fermian Hamiltonians, and this is the most general form. Over free-Fermian Hamiltonian, if the charge is conserved, it's a sum of A dagger A. There are two important requirements. First, there must be an energy gap, otherwise this classification doesn't work. The energy is bounded from below and from above. And second, if we consider a system not in dimension zero, but in high dimension, the H matrix should be local. If we think of it as a hopping amplitude, the electrons cannot hop too far. And such Hamiltonians have some rather simple properties. The ground state can be characterized in terms of the k-dimensional subspace in this space. It's the mode space. And it's the same as defining a spectrum flattened Hamiltonian, where all the eigenvalues are replaced by plus and minus ones, but the eigenvectors are preserved. And these ground states can be parameterized by this kind of set, but that doesn't take the locality into account. So strictly speaking, those properties pertain to zero-dimensional systems.
Yes.
Yes, because otherwise we could rescale the spectrum and make the gap arbitrarily small. We must have some dimensionless parameter, and it's the ratio between the spectral gap and the upper band. Yeah, there must be some maximum energy scale. Yeah. It means that H tilde is the unit matrix.
So what is it, a gap system? Right? Okay.
Yeah. Zero corresponds to the Fermi energy. If all the energy levels are above the Fermi energy, it's not very interesting.
Yeah.
Now, we use the complex case theory to describe those Hamiltonians, and I have mentioned that already. We describe Hamiltonians, but there may be some complications. For instance, we may want to describe Hamiltonians depending on some parameter Q, and that may be momentum, but it also may be some other parameter. It may be a parameter the physical Hamiltonian actually depends on. And the set of stable homotopic classes of maps from Y to the classifying space, actually it's just the homotopic classes because the stability is guaranteed by this limit. Consider matrices of increasing dimensions and case the number of negative energy states, and these numbers N and M are added to facilitate the homotopy, because homotopy in high dimensions is simpler and stronger. And in a similar way, we can classify unitary matrices. Actually, unitary matrices can be viewed as Hamiltonians like that with a certain symmetry. So again, this is the first table. Now, how do we classify Hamiltonians without charge conservation? I prefer to use Majorana operators. There one can use the Nambu-Sphinner or some different basis. In the Majorana basis, the Hamiltonian is given by a real skew symmetric matrix. And again, we can flatten the spectrum by this transformation. And now the eigenvalues are plus or minus I. Such matrices, A tilde, can be obtained this way. We start with the standard matrix and apply an orthogonal transformation S. However, this representation is redundant because if S commutes with the standard matrix, then we get the same A tilde. And therefore, the set of A tilde or the set of S with the redundancy removed is this coset. It's O of 2n divided by un. Now let's put some symmetries in. There is the charge conservation. It's described by the particle number operator, and it can be written in terms of the Majoranas. And again, we get the same standard matrix representing the charge operator. And that matrix must commute with A if the Hamiltonian preserves the charge. The time reversal operator is some operated T hat. Hat means that it acts in the Fock space, and this is the definition of this T. I omitted the hat. It acts by conjugation on pi, and this equation means that T is anti-unitary, and it also flips the spin in a certain way. And again, we can write it in the Majorana basis, and the exact form of T is not important, but we care about some commutation relations between Q, T, A, and other things. First of all, Q and T are real skew-symmetric matrices, and they square to minus one, and they anti-commute. And this is already an interesting piece of structure. So Q and T generate a Clifford algebra. Now, if the Hamiltonian has this form, if H is Q-invariant, if H preserves the charge, then Q commutes with A. And if H is T-invariant, then T anti-commutes with A. And this minus sign is due to the fact that T anti-commutes with the imaginary unit. Now, we can make some technical improvement. We may introduce this operator E2, which is the product of the two symmetries, and A tilde, the spectrum flattening operator. And now, if there is no symmetry, then there is a single operator A tilde, and it squares to minus one. If there is T only, E squared equals minus one, A squared equals minus one, and they anti-commute. And with two symmetries, there are commutation relations of the same kind. And we see that to find Hamiltonians with a given symmetry, we first define some number of Clifford generators. We may have either zero, one, or two Clifford generators. And their action is fixed. We have some fixed representation of, say, E1 and E2. And we're adding a new Clifford generator to that system, and we want to classify all possible ways to define its action in the same space, in the same representation. And so to do the classification, even in dimension zero, we need Clifford algebra. And this, well, maybe I'll skip that. I'll need the definition there. This Clifford algebra with P positive generators and Q negative generators is defined this way. The positive generators are ones that square to plus one, and those ones square to minus one. And there are some properties of the Clifford algebra, and actually up to so-called Moretti equivalence, they only depend on P minus Q modulo 8. And this is the complete description. And this way, we can define the classification in dimension zero. There is one technicality. It is technically convenient to deal with positive generators. And we can trade Q negative generators for Q plus two positive generators up to Moretti equivalence. And this way, we obtain this table, where P is the number of positive generators, and it starts with 2, which corresponds to no negative generators, no symmetry at all, and this entry is familiar, and there are more entries. And we can also go in the other way, it corresponds to T, to the wrong time reversal symmetry, T squared equals 1. Now, this is the most important thing. How do we extend this classification to high dimensions? First, we need to define the problem rigorously, because the answer may depend on how we define it. And these are some general principles. This is not a very rigorous definition, but these are the important principles. First, we need to define an admissible phase, the phases we classify. And the important things are that they're gapped. These are free ferment phases. And if we don't want to restrict ourselves to gap systems, we at least must require that the electrons are localized. That will be enough. So we can deal with, say, Hall conductance with localized electrons, but with some non-zero density of states at the Fermi level. And we need to define equivalence between admissible phases. The equivalence is a stable equivalence. We may add any number of trivial degrees of freedom. These trivial degrees of freedom may be like inner electron shells. They're not really important. But they are important to make the definition of homotopy simpler. And finally, we will be classifying differences between phases, not phases themselves. And the difference classes form an abelian group. And there are three settings where this problem can be defined. One setting corresponds to continuous systems, like liquids, for instance. And such systems are described by Dirac operators. And well, my approach is not very different from the other approaches, but with Dirac operators, we may also describe long-range disorder. And the long-range disorder is characterized by a texture, a varying mass term. One can also consider band insulators. This seems to be the most practical description because most materials are actually band insulators, but it's actually the least intuitive approach because when we draw some pictures in the momentum space, they don't have direct physical meaning. That's a difficult thing. And besides, they have some extra invariants that are specific to the translational symmetry, like this numbers characterizing weak topological insulators. And finally, we can describe disordered systems using K homology. The main technical contribution of this work is this theorem that actually any localizing free Fermi Hamiltonian on a spin manifold, well, we can talk about RD. Any Hamiltonian in the Euclidean space is topologically equivalent to a texture. So short-range disorder is equivalent to smooth disorder. That is a non-trivial statement, but in fact, it's true. One can write some computer program that would convert a short-range matrix to a texture. But the catch is that we may need many Dirac modes, and the number of Dirac modes is proportional to the localization volume. No, I don't know how many modes I need in other cases. In all cases, I do not want to limit the number of modes because that may make the problem untractable. Yes. Yes. Well, it is a bit simpler, but still you need many modes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it is of course related. Actually, I have some explicit formulas on some of the following slides. I can jump to the formulas. Oops. Yeah, there it is. So if we want to describe a band insulator, we need to classify vector bundles on this finite torus. It's a key bar. Bar means that we actually consider bundles with the following property. If we replace Q by minus Q, Q is the coordinate on the torus, we simultaneously apply the complex conjugation. And those bundles are equivalent under such transformation. So if we want to classify such bundles, and P denotes the number of symmetries, Clifford symmetries. It's the same as calculating so-called K-homology on TD, the usual torus. And K-homology sounds more complicated than vector bundles, but in fact, it's more tangible because Ashwin told us this morning that there are extra layers, extra atomic layers with boundaries. And those boundaries carry some gutless models. So these chains and cycles, or and chains and boundaries in a certain homology theory, and this is exactly the K-homology theory, some specific type of K-homology. So K-homology are more intuitive than this object. And we can do some formal calculations, and eventually we get this thing. We get KO of a point, K theory of a point, which is one of those groups, Z, Z2, Z2, and so on. And for things that depend on the general solution invariant, we get KO tilde. Another K group, and this is indeed related to lower dimensions, and this is an example of that calculation in the well-known case of a 3D topological insulator. Of course, some people in this room have worked that hard using concrete representation in the momentum space, but at the abstract level, it's just this decomposition. We apply this sequence of transformations and we get a Z2, the distinguished strong topological insulator, plus three other Z2 numbers. Now, this calculation can be done in any dimension. Unfortunately, it doesn't replace the original calculation because if you show me a particular band structure, I would need to use the pedestrian approach. because this transformation is not easy to calculate.
It's not easy, but in principle you can do it.
Yes, oh. Yes, in principle you can do it. It's the case theory analog of Fourier transform.
Of what?
Of Fourier transform. So, how do we use Dirac operators? Let me illustrate that using the Majorana chain. It's a 1D example. But those Majorana modes arranged in a line, and there are two coupling constants, this black thing called U and the red thing called V, and they alternate. And if U is greater than V, then we have this pattern of dimers. If V is larger, then we have a different dimer pattern. And in that case, there are two unperturbed Majorana modes at the end of the chain. This is a topological phenomenon. But we can describe it using a continuum model. We can describe it as a soliton between two dimer patterns. And we may start with the situation where the two couplings are equal. Then there are two gapless modes, two Dirac fermions, eta 1 and eta 2. Then we introduce a mass term that changes like that. And we have the Dirac Hamiltonian of this form with the a mass term. And there is a zero mode when the mass term changes. It's related to the Atiyah-Singer index theorem. It's the basic example from which one can derive more complicated cases of that theorem. And here's one more complicated case. Maybe I'll tell about it in more detail next week. It's about this mercury telluride in contact with superconductor and ferromagnet. If we write the suitable Dirac Hamiltonian, the mass term is a matrix, and its Poiffian changes. And that tells us that there must be an unpaired Majorana mode. But in general, like Xu Liang told us, we may use Dirac operators, but he showed how to use them on the boundary. I'll do it in the bulk. And in the bulk, there is a mass term, and the Hamiltonian has this gamma matrices, which are real symmetric, and this, okay. The dimension of those matrices is not limited. It can be arbitrary, but we only need the right commutation relation. Now, the spectrum should be gapped, and in principle, we could consider terms with the second derivative, third derivative, and so on. But if we only care about the topological classification, there is a famous paper by Akia Bot and Shapiro, who showed that we want to classify functions or bundles on the sphere. In this case, the momentum space is a sphere. The infinity in the momentum space is just a single point. It's enough to, if we want to find the stable topological classification of such functions, it's enough to use linear functions. And that's why I'm using Dirac operators. I could use more complicated operators, but they're topologically equivalent. And if we think about this mass term should satisfy this equation. And if it's the other way around, then there is no gap. And those bad mass terms can be removed by homotopy. Now, if we put everything together, there is some number of symmetries. There are Dirac matrices satisfying those equations, and they anticommute these symmetries. And a mass term, and those things are fixed, but the mass term varies. And we want to classify such mass terms, and that will give us the complete classification of topological phases. Now we see that those gamma matrices are like symmetry operators, but with the opposite sign. And that's why we have the dimension shift. Those Dirac matrices should be considered as things that cancel symmetries. If there are P symmetries, P positive symmetries, then the important parameter is P minus the dimension. let's say 5 minutes. I'll go quickly. I'll go quickly through the following slides. And this is the same table. Now, let me just say a couple of words about disorder. In a disordered system, one can also define invariants like the Chern number. And this was done by Billy Sarr and by other people in connection with the quantum Hall effect. Here is one possible definition. One can consider the spectrum flattened Hamiltonian, transform it to a projector onto the occupied levels, and write this expression in terms of the projection matrix elements. Don't worry too much about the exact expression. It's only important that it's some local expression that only depends on a neighborhood of a given point. At any point, we can do some local calculation and find the Chern number. And this can be generalized to other topological phases. In some cases, I know how to generalize. In some cases, I don't. But in principle, it should be possible, and it should not be too important, because we only care that there is a local expression. By the way, there is some local, very nice local expression for a 1D unitary matrix, but I'll skip that. And let me show you this picture. If we believe that there is a local expression, we can argue very strictly that there must be a gapless mode at the boundary. More exactly, that states must be delocalized at the boundary. And the argument goes like this. Suppose that the states are localized everywhere. Then we can consider the whole system as a single phase. Under this assumption, one can define that local invariant, and that local invariant is independent on where we calculate it. So there is a continuous transition between the vacuum and the condensed matter phase, and we can calculate this local invariant in the vacuum. Obviously, we get zero, and here we don't get zero. But that is a contradiction, because the previous theory tells us that if the electrons are localized everywhere, this local invariant must be equal at all points. And the last thing I want to mention is the role of interaction. Basically, if we suppose that there is some pre-Fermian classification and some unknown interacting classification, there must be a map, because every pre-Fermian system may be considered as a special case of an interacting phase. And one may ask two questions: whether this map is surjective, or, which means whether every interacting phase has a pre-Fermian representative. And the answer is obviously no. This is a counterexample, the fractional quantum Hall effect. Here is a more subtle question. Is this map injective? If it is not injective, it means that there are two pre-Fermian phases that must become equal in the interacting classification. And there are counterexamples. You want a really simple counterexample. Here it is. Let's talk about Z4 symmetry. Non-interacting systems cannot distinguish between Z4 and U1. But it's easy to change the number of occupied states by 4 in an interacting system. And of course, there are more interesting examples. And this is an example I'm working on with Lukas Fitkovsky. It's a bundle of Majorana chains. We consider several chains, and there is a certain symmetry. This is the Ron T symmetry that doesn't allow electrons to hop from chain to chain in the vertical direction. They can hop diagonally, but not in the vertical direction. And it turns out that according to the non-interacting classification, there is an integer invariant. And if we have some number of Meyer-Rahner modes, at the end of those chains, we can just count them as an integer, and they don't cancel each other. However, in the interacting case, a set of 8 Meyer-Rahner modes can cancel in the sense that interaction opens a gap at the boundary. 4 is not enough, but 8 is enough. And in fact, there is a very nice field theoretic description of this model. One can define a phase transition and study the role of mass terms in interactions. And this is the summary. So I think that most of the questions related to non-interacting systems are understood, but this is not quite understood. In some cases, we know that interactions do not destroy the classification, like in the quantum Hall effect and in the 2D topological insulator. In other cases, we know that the classification is unstable, and we don't know the general principle that would tell us where it's stable and where it's not. Well, thank you.
So this, so when we talk about, for example, Yuxiao-Lenz talk, we were talking about fermions on the boundary.
Yeah.
And for if there's no Gauss theorem, it kind of tells you the bulk theory must be topological. There are no concrete examples to surface fermions. Classification for two different bulk and free fermion Hamiltonians, but they can be linked by exactly.
No, there is a counterexample.
For surface terms.
For surface terms. Yes, yes,
okay,
yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Because you can couple to the electromagnetic field. If they're U1 symmetric, then the trend in the electromagnetic action is invariant. True homotopy. It is always integer because that is required by the gauge symmetry, and it cannot change, say, from 0 to 1 without closing the gap.
But that's always the criteria, even with free fermion.
Yeah. Well, I want to give you some puzzle. I'm thinking about it right now, but it's an interesting thing. And Shuchen also thinks about that. Let's talk about systems with no symmetry in 2D. Then the topological classification is stable. And the way to see that is to calculate the energy current at the boundary at finite temperature. One can also use the chiral central charge if the H is described by some conformal field theory, but the conformal field theory is not necessary. This is an example where there is some ad hoc argument showing that the classification must be stable. There is an integer invariant. But it's not clear whether it's a special case of some more general concept. And it seems that it's related to the it's related to time, but the formulation of the problem doesn't know about time. So this time appears out of nothing. And, that is the puzzle.
Yongqing.
What theory, excuse me?
For each phase you discuss, whether there's a topological quantum field theory.
I don't know. It may be a topological classical field theory, like in the quantum Hall case, because it's a classical transient section for the electromagnetic field.
Yeah, I think that's good enough.
Yeah, yeah.
But do you have one term like that for every phase?
No.
No, why not? In principle, or we just haven't found them yet?
I cannot answer that either. In the case where this classification is unstable to interaction, there must be no such a term, because
right.
But in the case I just mentioned, this no symmetry case, there might be a term related to gravity, but it would be difficult to write this term because the Lorentz invariant is broken by the solid. And so I don't know how to write that term.
I also think this is one of the greatest open problems in the field. There are things which look, some cases, there looks like the topological term really knows about the fermion. But there are more examples from the fermion for which we don't really quite know the topological term.
So,
For Z2, I only know how to do that in one dimension, and it's an infinite determinant. It's not an infinite trace, or it's rather a determinant.
No, I didn't mean to.
I guess that's the answer. I know how to do it in 1D, but not in high dimension.
Okay, let's thank Alexa again. So the next talk is by Rahul.
So I'm going to talk about a work. So you know, the Z2 invariant can be understood in many ways, and this work I'm going to describe has been superseded by other descriptions. But I still think it's useful because it was useful for me to understand certain aspects of it, and it has certain nice connections. Certain results seem to follow much easier if you from this perspective, and. So this work was mostly done in Urbana. I'm currently a postdoc in McMaster, and I'd like to thank my advisor, Michael Stone, and Sheldon Katz, who is a mathematician and a string theorist, and Professor Zhang, who actually introduced me to this field over a visit to Stanford during one summer. Okay, and these are the papers it's based on. I hope that I can actually put a journal title to these very soon, but it's not in my hands right now. So I'm going to give a quick introduction because this is an expert audience. So what are some characteristics of topological phases in fermionic systems? Some general characteristics are there's often a topological invariant. There is in some cases a quantized response. This was actually something that we were used to, but it's not necessarily true for all systems. And there are often edge excitations. So let me just give a sort of cartoon picture using slides which I borrowed from Tang Hai Li, but I think they show this thing very nicely. So consider a Hamiltonian, 2x2 Hamiltonian in two-dimensional space where k is a good quantum number. And then you can write this Hamiltonian. Okay, So you can write the Hamiltonian in terms of the Pauli sigma matrices. And this Hamiltonian defines a map from the space of momenta in the Brillouin zone, kx, ky, to a vector with three components A, B, and C. Now, the gaplessness, the fact that this system, we require the system to have a gap. And if it is gapped, this means that this vector can never be zero. So if you represent the zero point here, you can draw the surface of the points A, B, and C as a function of kx and ky. And when you do that, you can have two different cases, the trivial or the non-trivial, and they are and they differ by the fact that this red point, which represents a point zero, is either inside or outside the surface. And it's very easy to see that, you know, this gives you a clear picture that these two cases are topologically distinct, because you can never go from here to here without this red point crossing the surface. And as soon as it crosses it, you close the gap, right? Okay, and you can define a topological invariant, and this is the famous TKNN index for two bands. I'm not going to talk much in detail about it. And this number can be any integer, and that would correspond to a number of non-trivial windings around this red point. So in this case, it corresponds to zero windings. In this case, it corresponds to one, but it can be in general any integer. So you know, this is the experiment which corresponds to this phenomena. Of course, I'm doing a little bit of cheating here, because this experiment is for a system with Landau levels, and you see this quantization. It's not in a periodic lattice system, which was the earlier thing I was describing. So that model was actually originally due to Duncan Haldane. So we see that in the integer quantum Hall effect, you have a topological invariant, you have quantized response, and you have edge excitations. Motivated by work in spin transport, a quantum spin Hall effect was proposed by Bernwig and Zhang and Kane and Melee in 2005. But note here that time reversal symmetry is not broken. And so this is a little bit of a surprise. This was originally proposed in the context of quantized spin current response. So it was thought that, you know, it was proposed so that it would meet this criteria for sure, quantized response. And you can also see that there would be edge excitations, because it turns out to be, at least in most of the cases where they were originally proposed, they could be thought of as two copies of the IQHE. However, the quantization of the spin Hall conductance is not protected. So you can add terms which easily destroy this. So that's not a protected phenomena. So then one can ask, is there something protected? And possible things that could be protected are edge states and topological invariants. So, and there were two surprises, which I think, you know, were quite surprising to the community, that which were noted by Kane and Melee, that you see both robust edge states and and there is something topological which is protected here, and these phases are topologically protected. So, so here are the edge states. So this is the non-trivial insulator, and this is the trivial insulator, and what about the topological invariant? In fact, they answered that question as well, and they said that they defined the topological invariant in terms of the zeros of a certain Pfaffian. So it's the Pfaffian, it's basically the Pfaffian of this matrix, which is putting the time reversal operator, sandwiching it between block states. You can show that this is anti-symmetric, and if you take the Pfaffian, you can see certain properties of this, that if there are zeros of this, they occur at two points, k and minus k, simultaneously. So this paper had just come out when I was visiting Stanford, and that's how I started thinking about this problem, because I couldn't really understand everything about it. So the quantum spin Hall phase is distinguished from the normal insulator by the number of zeros of this Pfaffian. So, you know, they had also a nice cartoon picture which showed that if you have two of these zeros, if you have two zeros of the Pfaffian, then they can never annihilate, because they always occur at k and minus k, and these points, the time reversal invariant points, are points where these zeros can never occur. They also showed that, and so this is a Z2 invariant. Probably if I'd understood this, I would have stopped working on it at the time. But so is robust edge states, which was shown empirically and believed to be true. There is no quantized transport, but there's a topological invariant. So there are these unanswered questions, at least in this formalism, which was that the connection of the topological invariant with edge states and what is the connection with the spin-Hall conductance. The second point, how do you identify experimentally or in materials? I should admit that these were not my motivations to study this. My motivation was just to understand it for myself, but it turns out that some of these things can be answered if you look at it from a different point of view. And as such, you know, the topological classification, so this is just a different perspective on this classification. One other perspective, for instance, the mercury-cadmium-telluride wells, you saw a single pair of edge states. And so one is tempted to conclude that this is a topological insulator, and this edge bulk connection was a part of the folklore in the community. People expected it. But I believe that you need to make something more firm and make a proof of this. And so one place one can probably think about looking at for guidance is the IQHE, where this, there's a lot of work by Hatsugai, Laughlin, and Professor Kitaev and Belisard. A lot of people had tried to contribute various things which made this bulk edge connection. This motivation is that, the original computation of the Z2 invariant was very tough. Now there are ways, especially when there is parity, but the Chern number formula is also, I think, a very useful way to construct a model. You can, for instance, this Bismuth paper came out by Murakami. In that model, you can actually just, starting from the Chern number formula, you can tell the Z2 invariant directly. You don't have to do any calculation at all. Okay, so the main results are that there is an observed formulation of the invariant. So the formula is very simple, but there's lots of caveats, and I have to explain these caveats because this is a very sophisticated audience. And the formula is simply E equal to N mod 2. And so N can be roughly thought of as the following. The spin-Hall conductance, if you have a model conserved spin, then the spin-Hall conductance is NE over 2 pi. Of course, I told you that this is not at a protected quantity, so... And the connection with edge states is very clear once you understand that the spin-Hall conductance is NE over 2 pi. Then, because we can understand the spin-Hall Hamiltonians, which have spin-Hall conductance quantized as two copies of the IQHE, the bulk edge connection is immediately clear. If N is even, then there is an even number of pairs of edge states. And by the arguments in a lot of papers who analyzed edge states, if you have even pairs, they're not robust. If N is odd, then there's at least one pair of robust edge states. I won't show the arguments which show that one pair of states is robust, because it's fairly well known and other people have talked about it. And there is a surprising connection with the integer quantum Hall effect. So the multiband generalization, that was for two bands, but if you have a multiband generalization, you take the sum of the positive Chern numbers. So N in that case was, so if you have a Hamiltonian which has a quantized spin-Hall conductance.
Right, I know, but then it's trivial. So what if you don't have
it? Yeah, so if you don't have that, then you take the sum of the positive Chern numbers of the band. And then you might ask, what if the Chern numbers are not well-defined? I'll answer that in a moment. Yes, so, but let's say, for instance, many, many simple models that were originally written have well-defined Chern numbers. You can easily define a Chern number for the spin-up band and for the spin-down band in your model, also for Murakami's and many. So it gives you a guidance. You can just directly calculate the. You can, if you want to write down or looking for a material where you want to have a topological insulator, you just write down a Hamiltonian with degeneracy at all points with well-defined Chern number and just say Chern number even, trivial Chern number odd, non-trivial. So that's the utility. More generally, you have to calculate if the energy eigenkets have well-defined Chern numbers, then Cn is the Chern number of the nth band. As you pointed out, however, in general, the bands touch each other because of time reversal. And what you can do in all of these cases, there's two prescriptions. Either you form functions which span the vector space corresponding to the filled bands, which again come in pairs. But this is the same thing that you also used in your work. basically you construct linear combination of the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian such that these linear eigenstates form a continuous set of wave functions which are time-reversed pairs on the entire momentum space, and then you can calculate the Chern number for each of these wave functions. And but the reason why that can be done will become clear as I explain how this is derived. And the other argument is that, so what I'm doing is basically I'm defining sets of Hamiltonians which are in some sense like your fixed points, you know, and you can flow all the other Hamiltonians to these fixed points. So the fixed points in some sense are the Hamiltonians which have well-defined Chern numbers. They need not have a well-defined spin or any such thing, but they have well-defined Chern numbers, and once you go to one of these Hamiltonians, it becomes quite trivial to calculate the Z2 invariant. Okay, and so this is nice because adiabatic arguments and the well-known bulk edge connection in the IQHE, so in the integer quantum Hall effect, once you have bands with well-defined Chern numbers, there's a very nice work by Professor Hatsugai and also other arguments by Laughlin and others which prove a bulk edge correspondence. So here then you get the bulk edge correspondence because now you've expressed the Z2 in terms of Chern numbers. And of course you have to use adiabatic continuity for the cases where the Chern numbers are not well-defined. Once you're doing this adiabatic continuity, you cannot destroy a pair of edge states because, so I just said this before, CN are the famous TKNN Chern numbers. And so this reveals a deep and somewhat surprising connection with the IQHE. It also leads to possible avenues for the many body Z2 invariants, such as one that will be the subject of the next speaker's talk. So now let me go into the mathematics of this work. So what happens is that you have a fiber bundle. So the wave function can be represented or be thought of as a section of a fiber bundle. In general, this fiber bundle is a U1 fiber bundle for a wave function in real space. But if you have momentum space, then you have a fiber bundle which has some UN degrees of freedom, like a UN sort of gauge field can be associated with this bundle, and as Professor Kitaev showed in his talk, you can redefine these bundles up to some unitary matrices, and that does not affect the ground state. So, but the fact that theta squared equal to minus one is very crucial. This leads to a twist in the fiber bundle, and so what we do is to find the homotopy of ground state wave functions. And this homotopy reveals two equivalence classes. And these different classes are classified by obstructions to a trivial bundle, which means that the trivial insulator has a trivial bundle. The non-trivial ones have an obstruction to being trivial. And a complementary and mathematically equivalent classification scheme, which is on the basis of the homotopy study of Hamiltonians. In fact, that seems to be the more generic and more common way of understanding it. I'm basing that on other work. There's a lot of work which classify Hamiltonians. I was looking at the wave functions. For instance, Moore and Balentz looked at the classification based on the Hamiltonians. I had already said this, you know, this is not really a good cartoon for a fiber bundle, but okay, so now there's a famous example of a twisted fiber bundle, which is what I was trying to show before, and this is the Dirac monopole. So the Dirac monopole is basically this problem where you enclose a magnetic monopole by a two-dimensional sphere. And Dirac and Wu and Yang showed that there is no uniform gate choice which works on both the north and the south hemisphere. So for any U1 wave function, for any gauge field and for any electronic wave function, you have to choose two different gauges, and you have to connect them with a gauge choice on the boundary. And the winding of the U1 gauge at the boundary is equivalent to the monopole charge trapped inside the sphere, right? So what I claim is that, you know, it might be, so this is a twisted bundle. And so you see that, you know, there is, I can draw a line along this Mobius strip. And if I try to define the Mobius strip, this is not exactly a cylinder. And the difference is that I have to twist it to connect it. So this twisting is vital. And so, the ground state is twisted. Sorry? Of T2. In this case, it's the circle. full Brillouin zone. It's a full Brillouin zone. It's a full Brillouin zone. Yeah. So the ground state is twisted in some sense, in the same sense that this is twisted, and the twist is measured by the monopole charge. So in the IQHE, in the Dirac monopole, the twist is measured by the monopole charge. The Z2 invariant can be thus roughly thought of as a Z2 monopole. So here's a representation of the momentum space, and I divide it into five regions, okay, A, B, C, D, and E. Why five, you might ask? Because there's periodic boundary conditions here and here and here and here. So I can be sure that with five regions, I have locally flat wave functions. It turns out that in this case, T2 equals to S2, so I don't have to worry about cutting it up into five regions. So that's what I'll do. I will cut it up into two regions, okay? And my momentum space, and this is a region E, and this is a region E prime. On both of these regions, I choose locally flat wave functions. So in other words, I choose a set of wave functions which are time-reversed pairs of each other on both of these things. And this can be done because these are basically, there's nothing topologically non-trivial about both of these regions. So I can do that, but now there'll be some sort of, when I try to glue them back together, just like when I try to glue the Mobius strip together, I find a twist. So there might be a twist when I try to glue the wave functions here and here. So basically when I try to do this, because I've imposed time reversal, it means that if I parameterize the boundary by this, if I parameterize this boundary by an angle phi, then the point at phi and the point at phi plus phi are related. And once I do that, once I impose time reversal, I find that the gluing transition matrix at phi plus phi, if the transition function at phi is written in this way, at phi plus phi it's written in this way. And more generally for two N bands, you can decompose it into a U1 part and an SU2N part, and time reversal requires these conditions on these two parts. So it turns out that there are two cases. First, if you have, I showed you that this is the most general condition here. There's a number P here, and the phase winding at pi is either the negative of it plus P pi, or it's always this, and P is either even or odd. And these two conditions lead to two different classes. The even condition corresponds to the constant of the trivial. The odd condition is the one which is non-trivial. And now, since this is a unitary matrix, I can always deform it into a diagonal matrix. And once I do that, I can, in fact, then just say that I will, in the diagonal basis, I will only have two non-zero elements corresponding to the twisting. And then this is the non-trivial case. So basically, there's just two different transition functions, and every transition function can be continuously deformed to one of these two categories. So thus you can, and then if you just want to define the Z2 index, you just look at the windings of the diagonal elements and you sum them up, take the modulo 2. So you define it, and the windings of the diagonal elements are nothing but the Chern numbers. So basically this gives rise to this formula where E equal to C mod 2, where C is the sum of the positive Chern numbers of the bands, of the filled band. Okay, so this is in words what I just said. So now, so you count the number of positive monopoles. So if you go back to the monopole picture, now you just count the number of positive monopoles mod 2. And what you can do is, you can, so there will always be bands with pairs of monopoles P and minus P. So each pair of monopoles P and minus P can be associated with a Z2 monopole whose charge is P mod 2. And then the Z2 monopole satisfies the rule 1 plus 1 equals 0. Whereas, the ordinary Dirac monopole satisfies 1 plus 1 equals 2. So what this leads to is that, one, it leads to a nice edge state connection. It's easy to compute in various cases of interest. Not in every possible case, but in certain cases of interest. It helps you especially to formulate models with non-trivial. I'm going back. Okay. Yeah, and so if this is a topology changing phase transition, if you want to have that, but this is somewhat out of the flow. Now, there is a different way of understanding this, which is actually related to the previous picture, where you can understand this in terms of band touching. And so you imagine that, okay, I should say that this argument requires you to look at the bands in a particular way. As Professor Kane pointed out, there's always a touching here, but you can write down some Hamiltonian for your system, which has band touchings at points k and minus k, and these are band touchings below the Fermi surface. So there's two occupied bands, and you make it such that they are degenerate in some region, then they open up a gap, and then there's a band touching at some point k and another point minus k, and you can then ask yourself, what is the change in the monopole number for each band? What are the possible changes? And you will find that the monopole number change is always even. If there is some band touching here, and there's a monopole number there which changes by n, there's another monopole number which changes at minus k, so that the number is always even. So that's a heuristic argument which actually helped me to understand this irrationally. So basically the claim is that there are equivalence classes of Hamiltonians which are identified by elements. So there's representative elements which are tensor sums of IQHE Hamiltonians, and this gives rise to a bulk edge correspondence, and also it helps us. So I wanted to relate it to the work of Fu and Kane on the Z2 pumping, where they actually had a very nice paper in showing that you could understand the Z2 in terms of a pumping argument. But their work was also based on an obstruction argument, and so I just thought I'd make the connection. The difference between our papers is that, I guess, in my case, so if you imagine this is your two torus, I'm drawing the line here and separating E and E prime, whereas they basically considered half the Brillouin zone, that was the boundary between the two. So it's like there's two ways of cutting an orange. You can cut it down the equator, or you can cut it down a great circle. So I cut it down the equator, and they cut it down the great circle. That's the difference. But, you know, the two regions are defined differently, but as you would expect, the expect... about 10 minutes, is that okay? Okay, so the Fu-Kane formula involves all the bands over half the Fermi surface. My formula involves half the bands over the entire Fermi surface, and these two pictures are equivalent. And, though I did not make a flux insertion argument from the IQHE analogy, one can consider such an insertion argument. And what my picture leads to is that there's a pumping of an odd number of pairs of time reversal connected particles if you pump a full 2π flux through the system or through a vortex of the system. And it actually, this work at least helped me to understand the fractionalization results of Ying Ran and Shalanki et al, Ying Ran and Ashwin Vishwanath. And so basically, you can understand it because, you know, you understand all your Hamiltonians as copies of IQHE. So what about 3D? So this work, you know, was done by three groups, the 3D topological phases and, you know, various properties of these. So you've heard a lot about these. I just wanted to talk about some aspects of this, which is the existence of four different invariants. So one particular interpretation of the 3D non-trivial insulator, or the so-called strong insulator, is that these have trapped monopoles in momentum space, in the sense that you always have an odd number of them, and they can never vanish. I should say, of course, that monopoles lie in the eyes of the beholder here. You have to look at it from a particular way, because if you write down the most general Hamiltonian, you will have one monopole sitting at k equal to zero. But you can separate them, and you can show that there's a pair of them which is trapped. And so one of the invariants is intrinsically three-dimensional, and this is stuff that you all know, the experimental realization. So let me just give an argument which shows that there are four distinct topological invariants for the 3D case. So first of all, this is the 3D Brillouin zone, and I consider these shaded regions. Then based on my formula, I can calculate the Z2 number for each of these three planes, right? And as Joel was pointing out, in fact, there are many more such planes. There's this plane, there's this plane, and there's plenty of planes here which are not shaded, which would also have these topological invariants because they map onto themselves under time reversal. So the point is that if you think about them in these trapped monopoles, the idea is that if there's a monopole in any one of these regions here, so let's say this particular region here, that's, what's it, 1/8 of this Brillouin zone, then there is going to be a monopole corresponding to this in the other, you know, the other 1/8 region, basically. And so now if you consider how my Z2 invariance can change from here to here, it must be the same as the Z2 invariance from here to here. I'll give you another argument, which is the following. Consider this plane here, and consider the plane Z equal to 0 here, okay? So now you can look at this plane and this plane together as the following. You can consider this boundary and then go down here and then continue it all the way here because this is the same as this. So now this defines a 2D plane, which is a sort of weird 2D plane, which maps onto itself under time reversal. Now I can continuously deform this plane so that I bring it down a little like this, and then I finally get it to be, you know, all the way across. And then I finally get it to be this. So I get this plane. This is a two-dimensional plane. And this has a well-defined Z2 invariant. And the Z2 invariant of this plane is simply the sum of the Z2 invariants of this plane and this plane. So so that's, let's see, y equal to 0 and x equal to pi. So the sum of the Z2 invariants of y equal to 0 and pi is the same as the sum of the Z2 invariants of x equal to 0 and y equal to pi. So that tells you that there are exactly four. I mean, you can use this argument for the other planes as well, and I think it's a simple picture to see this. Okay, so that's, you know, so if you define the Z2 invariant for this plane, then you're done. Then you have defined Z2 invariants for all four planes. Okay, and how about the edge state picture? So just another few minutes. Okay. So let's imagine that first you have an insulator in the weak topological class. This is well known knowledge, and this is not my work, but I'm just explaining it from the perspective of my paper. So the bulk edge correspondence says that okay, there's a at kz equal to zero you have a Z2 insulator, and at kz equal to pi you have a Z2 insulator. So this is a weak topological class material. And so you expect that there'll be, you know, a 2D Dirac spectrum here, there'll be a 2D Dirac spectrum here, and if you ask yourself how you can connect them, then in general it has to connect by some line like this. So so if you have the Fermi surface at some point here, the number of enclosed Dirac monopoles is 2, and this was explained well in Professor Kane's paper. You know, this is another view of the same thing, so this is kz equal to 0 and kz equal to pi, and you see an even number of crossings of the Fermi surface with the energies. Now, what about the case where kz equal to 0 is non-trivial, but kz equal to pi is trivial? Then there is a gap here, because this is not a Z2 insulator, whereas there is a Z2 insulator here, so that there is actually a 3D Dirac cone here. And if you have your Fermi energy somewhere in between here, then you would have trapped one. You would be enclosing one Dirac cone. And so this is a different cross-sectional picture of that same diagram. And okay, that's it, actually.
Next talk is by Sunset Lee, and about antibodies.
So first, I'd like to thank organizers for having me here. It's amplifying us. Yeah. I will speak up. So I will talk about many-body generalization of V2 topological invariant for quantum spin Hall state. And this work is done in collaboration with SpinCellU. So the question that I would like to address is the following. We know that this quantum spin Hall state cannot be smoothly connected to trivial insulator in the space of non-interacting states. And one has to go through this phase transition, gapless point. But if we include a general many-body state that cannot be written as Slater determinant, then still, is there no smooth path that connects this topological insulator to trivial insulator? So that's the question. So if there is no such path that smoothly connects without going through a phase transition, then this quantum spin Hall state will be generically different state from trivial insulator, even in many-body sense. So I think by now we very confidently know that the answer is yes. So they are really different states. For example, many people have suggested threading pi flux and then ask whether this state there are two degeneracy or not. And this is well defined for a finite system because this HMOs have a excitation gap in finite system. And then if there is a degeneracy, then it will distinguish it from a trivial insulator. And this definition works for even many-body state. And this is kind of a property of excited state. And in this talk, I would like to come up with a method which can tell whether a many-body state is in a topologically non-trivial state or not, just from ground state. And this morning we heard Joel Moore's talk where from magnetoelectric response one can also distinguish topologically non-trivial state from trivial state. So before discussing about this quantum spin Hall state, it's instructive to review this integer quantum case. So in the integer quantum state, different integer quantum states are characterized by this Chern number. And in the non-interacting case, the Chern number can be computed from non-interacting Bloch state. And this Chern number can be also generalized to interacting case where there are electron-electron interaction or disorders. And in that case, there's no momentum or band structure, but one can put the system on a two-dimensional torus and thread magnetic flux along two cycles and ask what is the ground state at each value of flux. And then one can treat this flux like a momentum, and then this many-body state like a Bloch state. And then from that, one can compute the Chern number. And this agrees with this one in the non-interacting limit. However, this is well-defined in many-body case. And since Chern number can be well-defined as far as there's a gap in the bulk, and since Chern number is quantized, this means that if two states have different Chern number, then one cannot go from one state to the other state without going through a phase transition. So existence of quantized in topological invariant implies that even in many-body sense, those two states are really distinct. So the goal is to come up with this kind of quantity that can be computed in general many-body states. So if there is no interaction, then we know that this quantum state can be basically understood as time reversal symmetric copy of two copies of integer quantum state. And then as Raoul just mentioned, the term number for each band is well defined. But if SG spin is not conserved, then this band can touch below the Fermi surface without closing a gap. Therefore, the term number can be transferred from one band to the other band. So term number for each band is not well defined. Nonetheless, if there's a time reversal symmetry, if there's a term number transfer at momentum k, then there's same term number transfer at minus k, which implies that term number can change by only even number. Therefore, the parity can be still well defined, and this can be due to invariant. And there are also many other, and this particular picture is due to Rahul Lohi, but there are many other methods that can be applied to non-interacting system. So what is the interacting generalization for this D2 invariant? So even though this method can be generalized to other model, here I will focus on the Kane and Meles model, where there are two sites within a unit set. And then first I put the system on an odd by odd periodic lattice. It's a torus in two dimensions. And then as we did in the integer quantum state, we thread magnetic flux along the two cycles of the torus. And then one can define uniquely a state at each value of the flux. And in the quantum spin hole state, because of the time reversal symmetry, the term number is always zero. Therefore, just by looking at the ground state, it is hard to probe non-trivial topological structure. And non-trivial topological structure is inside the ground state. It is, so one has to look into a substructure of ground state to probe non-trivial topologies. That's why in the non-interacting case, we have to look at each band, not just the sum of the band. So one trick is to look into the substructure of ground state is to do some surgery. So if I have a ground state which have two n particles, then I can create a Cramer's doublet by, say, annihilating n electrons on sublattice A. And then the other state is the Cramer's doublet of the first state. And this is like a many-body Cramer's doublet. And then in the non-interacting...
Does it depend on the number of
particles? Yeah, so how many electrons I annihilate depends on the size of the...
Number of
on unicell.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I annihilate half of them. And in the non-interacting picture, these two many-body doublets are very easy to understand. Basically, if SG is conserved, then I'm annihilating all spin of electrons. And this state is nothing but the Slater determinant state of spin down. And this, the other state, is the Slater determinant of spin up state. So the point is that even though the ground state has trivial term number, these descendant state may have non-trivial term number. And then one can define a two-dimensional Hilbert space spanned by these two many-body descendant states. Yeah, that's why I have to put the system on an odd by odd lattice. Yeah, that's a crucial point. Yeah. Yeah, so we can. So here I have two sites, right? That's like two orbitals. Oh, you are worried about? Yeah, so, but I think the way I annihilate these electrons are not very important. So I could have annihilated one more electron, for example, to create a many-body state, which have other number of states. And if you have disorder, and there is no unicell in any way. And then, so these descendant states may have non-trivial term number. And if they have non-trivial term number, it is known that we cannot define this state uniformly in a single patch in the space of flux. So these states have to vanish at some point, forming a vortex in the phase. And they have different vortex if they have different term numbers. However, and more generically, there can be some one-dimensional line in the two-dimensional space of flux where these two states fail to span two-dimensional space, two-dimensional state. For example, the norm of one state may continuously decrease and vanish along some one-dimensional line and may change sign. However, one can uniquely define two-dimensional Hilbert space even on the red line, which smoothly connects the two-dimensional Hilbert space across the line. So basic point is that in this scheme, one can uniquely define two-dimensional Hilbert space at every point in the space of flux. And these two states form a Cramer's doublet, many-body Cramer's doublet. And once I have this Cramer's doublet, then I can apply the same method that we learned from 9-13 system to compute G2 invariant. So one method is by using the non-abelian SU2 variegated field. So we have two states at every point in the space of flux. And then from that, we can define SU2 variegated field. And because of the time reversal symmetry, the doublet at flux minus alpha can be obtained by applying time reversal operator to doublet at flux alpha up to some unitary transformation. And because of this relation, the very connection at minus alpha is related to very connection at alpha through some Bayesian transformation. And then one can compute a Wilson loop for this SU2 variegated field that goes through these four time reversal symmetric points of flux. And then because of this connection between alpha and minus alpha, all contributions cancel with each other except for those unitary transformation at those four time reversal symmetric points. And one can show that this Wilson loop can have only two values, one or minus one. So it is quantized. And if we apply this method to non-interacting system, it has minus one for quantum spin Hall state and is one for trivial insulator. But this method is well defined for general many-body state, and it can be computed as far as the number of particles, the global U1, and the time reversal symmetry is preserved, and there's bulk gap. So the only way that, generically, the only way that this G2 invariant is not well defined is whether this global U1 or time reversal symmetry is broken, or there is some collapse or bulk gap. So this implies that any two states which can be adiabatically connected in the space of time reversal conserving and global U1 conserving state, they should have the same G2 number in this many body between variant. And this is equivalent to the following statement, where if two states have different G2 number, then they have to go through either phase transition or they have to break either two of the symmetry. And this same method can be applied even to three-dimensional case. We can just put the system on a three-dimensional torus as we did for the two-dimensional case, and then construct this descendant state from the many-body ground, many-body state, and compute this Wilson loop in the three-dimensional space of fluxes. And here is a summary. So this particular one is sensitive only to the strong or weak. Weak one can be defined by computing only, say, in the plane. And there are three planes. Yeah, it's like if you have a stack of 2D layers, and then this loop can have non-trivial value, but this loop can also have same non-trivial value. Then this number is trivial, but yeah, just like the non-interacting case. So this G2 invariant can be well defined in the presence of many-body interactions or disorder. Therefore, any two states which have different G2 number cannot be adiabatically connected to each other without going through a phase transition. And some open question, I think, is that there's no unique way of constructing this descendant state where we compute this G2 invariant. So it might be that there are more than one G2 invariant, but as far as this non-interacting quantum spin Hall states are concerned, the G2 invariant does not depend on how we construct this descendant state. But in general interacting many-body state, there could be some state which are sensitive to the way we construct this descendant state. And I think this question is related to the question where is there some truly many-body topological insulator which is really distinct from this non-interacting topological insulator, such as a fractional version of quantum spin Hall state, and if so, what is the topological characterization for those interacting states? Thank you for your attention. So, for example, in this KN and MLS model, I choose A sublattice, for example. It doesn't matter for non-interacting states whether I remove them on the A sublattice or B sublattice, they give the same G2 number for this non-interacting quantum spin Hall state. Yeah, for example, I could do that. Yeah. Yeah, so the question is there any interacting state where they give different G2 number? If so, that corresponds to some new many-body state that cannot be adiabatically connected to non-interacting version. You mean this one?
Yes. That equivalent to put one of the shell flux.
One of who?
One of the shell flux instead of one of bone flux.
No, I think I'm using only magnetic flux here.
Yes.
And insert this flux very slowly, there, so electric flux, electric field is vanishing small. So you're saying in a periodic boundary condition.
But we would like to be able to do anything that doesn't break time with this.
Yeah,
we would like to be able, I would like to allow this kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Somehow,
we don't have to.
Yeah, it's a little restricted.
Yeah, we didn't try that, but in prior there's no reason why we shouldn't. Totally different. Yeah, I think so.
Okay, let's go.
Fractionalization. Oh, okay. No signal. First, I would like to thank the organizer of this workshop. This is really a wonderful workshop. Yeah, just in time. My talk is not directly related to common Singhal effect, but however, because both the quantum spin Hall system and quantum Hall system belongs to the topological phase of matter. So my hope is that, yeah, what I'm going to talk about here may have some, may contain some lessons which will be useful for the quantum spin Hall system. So the title is a topological or discrete algebra in the fractionalization. So here, we want to try to use some topological discrete groups or algebras to characterize abelian topological phases in fractional quantum Hall system. And recently, we are able to prove that the fractional topological numbers actually are all topological invariants. This is why experimentally the quantization of the fractional chart, for example, or fractional statistics are protected by topological reasons. So this work, contains two works in collaboration with, Professor Mahito Komoto and Dr. Sato. So basic question here is, how to characterize or classify topological matter or phases. Of course, up to now, there have been several possible approaches. in a laboratory, we have known, two important systems which are in the topological phases. These are the quantum Hall effect and quantum spin Hall effect of systems. Also, theoretically, there are some models or candidates. for integer quantum Hall effect, which is the earliest example of the topological matter, we know that the system has a topological number, which is called the Hall conductance. When the Hall conductance is non-zero, we are sure that the system is in a topological phases. Also, a very important feature of the integer quantum Hall effect is that there is a Burke edge connection or correspondence. In this workshop, we have several talks dealing with this already. for a fractional quantum Hall system, which arises only due to interactions among particles. So indeed, this is a many-body effect. So in that case, we have learned topology-dependent ground state dependency. Namely, if we put the system on a compact two-dimensional manifold, then the ground state degeneracy will depend on the topology. On sphere, usually it's not degenerate, but on torus or higher genesis, we should have ground state degeneracy, which depends on the genus of the system. Also, in fractional quantum Hall effect, we know that the quasi-particle chart and the particle statistics are fractional-like. Okay, so in our approach, we just try to combine these features together by using a algebraic topology. But however, the algebra of the discrete group arises from the topological considerations. Our topological discrete algebra apply to many-body systems with interactions and disorders. And our the generators of our topological discrete algebra acts on the Hilbert space of the many-body space. Actually, it acts on the parameters of the. It may, yeah, acts on the parameters of the many-body state. So the well-known braid group actually is part of our discrete algebra. We know that braid group can be used to describe anions which obey fractional exchange statistics. So if we consider a braid group on a plane, if we introduce the generators of the which exchange two quasi-particles on the plane counterclockwisely and also without including any other anions. So these operations we call generators of the braid group. So if we have capital N particles, they are N minus one such generators. These generators are known to satisfy the so-called braid group relation. Namely, if we consider two generators which do not involve the same particle, then these generators commute. If they involve one common particle, then they satisfy this relationship. So actually, it's known that these braid group relations are also satisfied by symmetric group generators. But for symmetric group, the generators satisfy one extra condition, which is sigma I squared equal to one. So then from these relations, in particular the second one, it's easy to prove that the one-dimensional irreducible representation of the braid group actually can be represented by a unimodular complex number. If we also require that sigma square equal to one, then we get the, this guy square equal to one, then theta can only be zero to pi, namely the usual boson or fermions. And when this condition is not satisfied, we can have arbitrary angular parameter theta for statistics. So because we know that the quasi-particles in the fractional quantum Hall space has the fractional statistics, so yeah, we can use a bridge group to describe the system. And a well-known fact about the bridge group is that actually the number of bridge group elements generators actually depends on the topology of the two-dimensional surface. Let us, for example, consider the torus case. In addition to the usual local exchange operation, actually there are two more classes of generators which moves quasi-particle along a non-shrinkable loop on the torus. We know that wind torus has a torus has two non-shrinkable loops. So we have rho I for the ith particle in this cycle, and the tau I for the ith particle along another cycle. It turns out that, yeah, the for these generators of a bridge group on a torus, the relationship actually is much more complicated. In addition to the usual bridge group relation on a plane, we have so many extra relations which describe how the tau I behave and exchange rho I, yeah, and also, yeah, there are, you know, commutation relations, so on. And also, because surface, the torus now has non compatible loops, so there's a lot of new relation. And yeah, in John Berman's work, yeah, it's been proved that these relations are complete. So, however, we know that the flux inversion also plays an important role in quantum Hall effect because of Laughlin's argument. So essentially, yeah, when we insert a magnetic flux and turn it on, threading the hole of the two-dimensional system, and we turn the flux from zero to one flux quantum, so the net result actually is equivalent to a so-called large gauge transformation. So we introduce an operator we call the U sub X, which describes the large gauge transformation of the flux, which through one hole, and the U sub Y through another hole. And these large gauge transformations actually satisfy the following properties with the bridge group generator. So in particular, we can see that, yeah, when we insert a flux in this direction, these U sub X do not commute with moving the quasi particle around the closed loop here. The reason is that, yeah, if we first move the particle and then thread the flux, the motion of the quasi particle does not see the effect of the threading flux. However, if we first insert a flux, then we have the quasi particle move around the loop. The particle will see the flux. Sense. Okay, so these two actually should give us this difference, actually, the phase factor here, which depends on the flux, the fractional charge of the quasar particle. Okay, so yeah. From the braid group point of view, we can see that these large gate conformations are automorphism of the braid group on the torus. Okay, so from the relationship between braid group reflectation, if we assume that our quasi particles satisfy abelian statistics, okay, namely sigma j is given by this anion phase times an identity, then we call the system is in abelian topological phases. Then using the braid group relation, we can see that all tau j actually is related to tau 1 by this formula. So the Tx essentially is tau for the first particle. And similarly for the translation along another loop, it has a relationship here. And J, yeah, appears in these phases. Then it's very easy to verify that tau x, tx, ty do not commute. They satisfy such a relationship. Namely, if we move a quasar particle once and that one, and we compare, we go it in the opposite ordering. There is a phase. This phase depends on the statistic parameter. So yeah, essentially we can summarize our fundamental discrete algebra, the commutation relation like this. Namely, statistic parameter appears in a commutation relation between x and y. And for fractional charge, it appears in the relationship between txy and uxy. And yeah, for commutation relation between ux and uy, the large gauge transformations in different holes, we also require that they are proportional to a phase here. Actually, we can argue because these U's are automorphism of the braid group. So if we consider the irreducible representations, you know, the difference of the two parts can only be a scalar. So that later we'll see what is the phase meaning of that. Then we may consider the representation of this algebra. It turns out that, yeah, so we can determine the minimum dimension of the Hilbert space for the for the representation of this algebra. And this dimension actually, yeah, when it acts on the ground state, this dimension gives us a minimum ground state degeneracy. So the theorem is that given theta, a fraction value which is m over n, and is fractional charge to be p over q, then the ground state degeneracy actually is given by small n times q squared. And q is determined by the requirement that small n, n over q is equal to a ratio of a coprime, capital N and the capital Q. And the minimal ground state degeneracy is the small n times Q squared. So this is a general theorem which determines the minimal ground state degeneracy from the representation of the algebra, from the parameters, fractional statistics, charges. Okay, so one well-known example is the case when theta equal to pi over n and the E star is equal to E over n. When n is odd, this gives us the Laughlin's state. In this case, the minimal ground state degeneracy is on a torus. It's just n. Actually, we can work out explicitly the matrix representation for the generators T sub S Y and U sub X and Y. Another example is that if theta is not an anion, but the usual boson in the fermion, in this case, the minimal ground state degeneracy is given by Q squared. Actually, when we consider the fractionalized frustrated spin liquid, this is a case which may happen. Namely, we don't have anions, but however, the system still has a ground state degeneracy when we put the system on a torus. This is the representation of the generator, which gives us the minimal ground state degeneracy. I mentioned these two cases because previously in the literature there was a puzzle, namely in certain cases we have the ground state degeneracy of the q to the power g. For torus we have g to 1. So the first case is the Laughlin's case. The second case, as I have mentioned, it's the ground state degeneracy q squared times g. So the question is, the puzzle was, why in certain cases ground state degeneracy torus is q, but in another case it's q squared. From this topological discrete algebra, we can see the why this is true. So actually, there are more examples. Depends on whether Q and N are coprime. In this case, the ground state degenerates this one, and mathematically, there are some other cases. Okay, when the M is the denominator of the fractional statistic equal to 1. You can get different ground state degeneracy and so on. From these representations, actually, we can work out what's the value of lambda. In all these cases, ux, uy, and uy, ux just differ by phase. So this means that maybe five minutes. Okay, yeah. So the physical meaning of the parameter lambda actually is related to the quantized Hall conductance. It can be shown that the Hall conductance in this case is given by E square over H with an integer I over L, namely L is the denominator of the fractional quantum Hall conductance. If the will change the truth the phase to phi plus 2 pi. However, an extra phase is allowed. This extra phase actually is a Barry phase, which can be obtained by integrate the Barry's connection over the adiabatic phase. Then, in the same way as in Komoto's paper for calculating the TKN number, we can apply it to the many-body case and prove that the Hall conductance actually is given by this integral fxy is just very curvature. And yeah, this relation and also the commutation relations between u's actually give us this result, namely sigma xy, the fractional part actually is K over L. Recently, Sato and I, using this one, have shown that actually statistical parameters can also be expressed as a topological invariant in terms of many-body wave function. Here, we need to introduce many-body states with quasi-particles located at some position. Then the translation operator along one cycle give us a relationship like this. Again, here we can have some Barry phase. Then we can also define Barry's connection for many-body wave functions with the quasi-particle position as the parameters. Then we can show that the integral of Barry's curvature should give us a topological invariant. And the fractional part actually is given by the fractional statistics. Okay, so fractional statistics actually is also a topological invariant. But what's different is that for the fractional quantum Hall case, conductance case, we use ground state wave function. But here, we use wave function with quasi-particles. Similarly, fractional charge is also a topological invariant. So what we need to consider is to introduce both trace phase and quasi-particle position. Then similarly, we can consider the various connection with respect to the trace phase and with the particle location. Then we can define the integral of Barry curvature, yeah. And in this case, it can be shown that actually P over Q, which is the fractional charge, is just the fractional part. But in this formula, yeah, we have a D appears. D here is the ground, is the degeneracy of the many states with principal particle. So the summary is that, we have proposed to characterize 2D abelian topological spaces by means of a discrete algebra which has a topological origin. Basically, it's a red group and the gauge invariance and the large gauge transformation. So this algebra reveres the interplay between the annual statistics fractionalization and topological number. It can be used to determine the minimal ground state degeneracy without assuming relations between the fractional statistics, fractional charge, and the fractional quantum Hall conductance. Namely, the framework is quite general. Then, using this algebra, we are able to prove that all observables for the topological phase actually are topological invariants. Actually, as it should be, because if we believe that the low energy effect theory of the topological phases are described by topological quantum field theory, then the low energy observables should be all topological invariants, as in topological quantum field theory. Because in topological quantum field theory, all observables are topological invariants. Okay. Of course, in our framework, we cannot determine the relationship between the parameters of the topological phases. And in physics, we know that, for different materials, in many cases, there may be relationship between these parameters. But the mechanism for the relationship between these parameters should be studied case by case. Okay, so future direction is whether this can be generalized to quantum spin Hall effect or B2 topological invariant, or generalized to non-abelian phases. Non-abelian phases must be more complicated because we believe that the fusion algebra for the quasi particle species should be included. Also, add Burke correspondence, because when we want to study the edge Burke correspondence, we need to have a cylindrical system. Similarly, we can consider the braid group and the large gauge transformations on it. On a cylinder. Finally, is whether there are higher dimensional generalization of such algebra. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so let's do the thing.
So this is a very good question. I can tell you my belief. My belief is that they are related. But however, how to work out the connection between these, many body states with excitations and many body states with only the ground state. In certain sense, I feel that my feelings that there should be, theoretically, there should be some consistency conditions which constrain this relationship. Right now, I'm not able to do that. Although I believe it's true.